All right, let's go ahead and open our Bibles to Daniel 3. Decisions. Kathy and I had the opportunity and the honor, I suppose you could call it, to participate in the wedding of our niece. She's actually our second cousin, but we call her our niece. And I did the ceremony, but it was interesting as we talked with them in pre-marriage counseling about decisions and the importance of the decisions that you're making. And I tried to reinforce that yesterday with them as I married them, that your decisions are what are going to make the difference in your marriage. And what we're going to talk about today is the impact of decisions, and especially the decisions that we have to make day to day and that we're being forced to make, whether we're in the workforce or whether we're in the government or wherever we are, we find ourselves, we're having to make decisions. I was a little disturbed yesterday morning heading to the wedding. I was driving by myself, and I was listening to a program called Fortress of Faith. If you haven't listened to it, you really ought to take time to look it up on the internet and listen to it. But they were talking about the way the Christian church is bowing to Islam, and especially the Pope and some of the other groups, and how they're trying to join with Islam and declare Allah and Jehovah the same. Even some accusations of Wycliffe in their translations of the Bible into Arabic are replacing the name of God with Allah. So it's very important that we, as we look at this passage, we may very well find ourselves in this. Someone may be writing the history of us one day, and we will be in this. You know, I've told you before, I have a pastor friend, and I told him a couple years ago, I said, both of us will most likely end up in prison. And I said, I hope that we share a cell and that we can rejoice in our suffering together. But very recently, 2 weeks ago, I believe it was, a text went out in this high school between the students as they were lining up for their graduation. And this is what the text said. It was a very, very brief, quick text, and it said, recite Lord's Prayer at graduation. Now, there's a reason that this text went out. And an article by Todd Starnes, and I've got a paraphrase of that article here. And listen as I read it to you. He tells a story of this graduation and the recitation of the Lord's Prayer by students who defiantly stood up for freedom of expression. And he starts it off and he says, in East Liverpool, Ohio, just moments before the graduation ceremony, the senior class gathered in a nearby auditorium, and together they decided to do something that would make national headlines. The week before, students learned that they would no longer be allowed to perform the Lord's Prayer as a song, a graduation tradition dating back some 70 years. The school district banned the song after the Freedom From Religion Foundation complained that the Lord's Prayer violated the U.S. Constitution and promoted religion. If you don't know about this group, they're a group out of Wisconsin. Fearing a possible lawsuit, the district dropped a tradition which seemed to appease the group of perpetually offended atheists, agnostics, and freethinkers from Wisconsin. The school district's decision devastated the entire community, especially students in the high school's esteemed music program. As the senior class was lining up to march, some of them began talking about that longtime tradition now outlawed, and they decided to text each other to stand up as a body and recite the prayer. Just after the valedictorian welcomed the crowd, the seniors stood to their feet and began committing their act of obedience. They began with, "Our Father, which art in heaven." One parent said, "I was very proud to see the youth, our future leaders, decide to stand up for what they believed in." Technically, and he goes on and he says, technically the seniors didn't break any rules. They were ordered not to sing the Lord's Prayer. You see, the school district didn't say anything about reciting the Lord's Prayer. And he always puts these little twists at the end. And he said, meanwhile, back in Wisconsin, those meddling menaces from the Freedom From Religion Foundation are muttering under their breath, curses foiled again. So there you go. What did Jesus tell us to do? He said to be wise as what? Serpents and harmless as doves. These young people were certainly wise, weren't they? I can imagine. That must have been a beautiful moment. I think there are some YouTube clips. If you go on and you do some YouTube searches, I think there might be some clips, some phone movies. But a powerful lesson for all of us to understand that we need to stand up. If we don't do it, no one else is going to. And they certainly will. And they really don't care what we say. They're going to try to shove what they want to say down our throats. And a lot of Christians believe you just need to kind of sit back and let the Lord take care of it. The Lord doesn't work that way. He only has our hands. He only has our feet and our mouth and our ears. We are his hands and feet. Now, can he do it on his own? Sure, he doesn't have to use us if he doesn't want to. He has given us the privilege to be used, and therefore we should be usable. So let's take a look at Daniel 3, and we're going to bounce back up for just a moment to verse 16, because I think it's important. Actually, let's back up a little farther than that. Let's look at verse 18, or 15 rather. I need to start wearing my glasses, I see. And Nebuchadnezzar here has been told, these three guys don't want to bow down to your statue, for those of you who haven't been here. And he says to them this. He says, now if you're ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the zither, the lyre, the harp, the drum, and every kind of music, fall down and worship the statue I made. But if you don't worship it, you will immediately be thrown into a furnace of blazing fire. And who is the God who can rescue you from my power? Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer to this question. If the God we serve exists, then he can rescue us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he can rescue us from the power of you, the king. But even if he doesn't rescue us, we want you as king to know that we will not serve your gods or worship the gold statue you set up. So they're looking at him and they said, you know, you can tell us to do this. You can say all these things, but we want you to understand we are resolute in our determination to do what is right. Are you resolute? Are you resolute when you're at work and somebody is making fun of Christ? You know, I was very, very amazed at this wedding. It's obviously a very worldly wedding, except for my part. And as soon as I finished the ceremony, everyone got as far away from me as they could. I would walk up to a group and they would kind of find a way to move away. It was kind of as if I was poison or something. And I told Kathy on the way home, I said, people don't like preachers because they feel as if they're a threat to them. And you see, these guys are looking at them and they're saying here, we're standing for what is truth. And the first thing that Nebuchadnezzar wants to do is he wants to get rid of that. He wants to throw it away from him, move it as far away from him as possible, because the ungodly do not want anything in their eyes that's going to show them what they really are. So he looks at them and he says, or they look at him and they says, if the God we serve exists, then he can rescue us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he can rescue us from the power of you, the king. But even if he doesn't rescue us, we want you to know we will not serve your gods or worship the gold statue you set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with rage, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And he gave orders to heat the furnace seven times more than was customary, and he commanded some of the strongest soldiers in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and throw them into the furnace of blazing fire. So these men in their trousers, their robes, their head coverings, and other clothes were tied up and thrown into the furnace of blazing fire. And since the king's command was so urgent and the furnace extremely hot, the raging flames killed those men who carried Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego up. And these three men fell bound into the furnace of blazing fire. Then King Nebuchadnezzar jumped up in alarm. Look at him. He jumps up in alarm and he said to his advisors, didn't we throw three men bound into the fire? Yes, of course, your majesty, they replied to the king. And he exclaimed, look! I see four men not tied walking around in the fire unharmed, and a fourth looks like a son of the gods. Nebuchadnezzar then approached the door of the furnace, a blazing fire, and called, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, you servants of the Most High God, come out. So Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the fire. And when the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's advisors gathered around, they saw that the fire had no effect on the bodies of these men. Not a hair of their heads was singed, their robes were unaffected, and there was no smell of fire on them. Nebuchadnezzar exclaimed, praise to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He sent his angel and rescued his servants who trusted in him. They violated the king's command and risked their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I issue a decree that anyone of any people, nation, or language who says anything offensive against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego will be torn limb from limb and his house made a garbage dump. For there is no other God who is able to deliver like this. Then the king rewarded Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So the first thing I want you to notice there in verse 14 and following is that his expression changes. He's filled with rage. In verse 14, he attempts to be very conciliatory toward these friends of his favorite advisor, Daniel. You remember, he didn't know that these were the three men. So when they appear before them, he wants to be conciliatory toward them because he realizes that they are part of his brain trust. They're the three, in addition to Daniel, who are the smartest men in his kingdom. He doesn't want to arbitrarily kill these men. But you see, this resolute stance in 16 and 18 changes his attitude and turns him into what I call here the rage monster. And you have to get a picture in your mind of what this looked like as his face changes, as the blood comes to his face and the steam's coming out of his ears, and he begins to stomp his feet and rage and foam at the mouth. You can get a picture of this because that's how these guys act. If you've ever seen anyone, if you've ever had the opportunity to be in a room with a person like this, you know what I'm talking about. I have had that opportunity, and it's not fun. These people act like idiots. A principal in the Northern Virginia would put a mirror behind his desk so that people, when they were rage monster type people, they could watch themselves in the mirror. And he realized when they would do that, that they would realize how stupid they sat and they looked. And they would quit, you know, as they saw themselves in the mirror. But you can see these people. You ever been a rage monster? Have you ever been one? I've been one before. You ever been one? Sure you have. You've had those opportunities. You might not have been as bad as Nebuchadnezzar, but you've been a rage monster at some point. So I want you to notice again how they respond in verse 16. They look at him and they say to him, we don't need to talk about this. We don't have to sit around and have a discussion. We don't mean any respect to you. But if our God exists, he will deliver us. But if he chooses not to, we still are not going to bow to you. But look what happens with this extreme king. The first thing he does is he commands that the furnace is heated seven times hotter than normal. And when he realizes that they have no intention to obey him, what he does is he flies into a violent rage and he just becomes totally irrational. And he asks that furnace be heated seven times hotter than it normally would be heated. So hot that it would literally crack the bricks that the furnace was made from. And you would have thought that what he really would want to have done was turn the temperature down so that the men would have to suffer for a while. I mean, you would really think that what he would want to do is he would want to put them in there, let them simmer at a lower temperature. But no, he wants this thing taken care of, and he wants it taken care of quickly. It's kind of that kind of person. He goes into these rages. He goes into these extremes. And if you've ever noticed how some people are prone to going off, you always notice that they lash out irrationally. Any type of person who goes off, they always become irrational in their thinking and irrational in their comments. Recently, I was watching a debate between Alex McFarland and atheist David Silverman. And throughout the debate, I was watching Alex, and his comments and his demeanor were always very honorable and respectful, and his words were calm. But Silverman repeatedly interrupted and ridiculed him. Every time Alex would get ready to say something, Silverman would throw out a red herring and begin to ridicule his position, never supporting his own, but always ridiculing the other position. And that's how these kind of people act. And it's a very wise thing, by the way, for you, if you want to know how to respond to these kind of people, take some time to watch some of these YouTube clips and watch how these people debate. And you'll see that there's a common way that they do it. There's a common way that they respond to truth. And if you look at that, it will give you some authority and some power when you're stuck in one of these situations when you have to oppose one of these people. You'll often also find that anyone who opposes God will rash out irrationally for no apparent reason. And it's simply because their rebellious nature wants to seek to fight against what they don't understand and what they can't see, and it wants to destroy it. And if you remember from back in the 50s when the big movement to get rid of God and destroy God came through, the big answer at that point was, now we've gotten rid of God, we can do as we please. It all comes back down to, we want to do what we want to do. So reflection on this particular passage should help us compel each of us to consider, how do we react to situations in which we don't get our way? Do we become enraged? Listen to me now. Do you become enraged? I struggle with that. There are times when I just am irrational. And I have lost my temper. Thankfully, God is helping me to work through those things and not be like that. But there are still times when it creeps up because we never totally get rid of it, do we? When we become irrational and we become a rage monster. Notice again that the king is determined that no one will rebel against his decree, so he overheats the oven. And I want you to think about something. Most likely this oven, this furnace is actually heated by petroleum, because back in those days the petroleum would bubble to the surface of the ground and they would dip it up, and it was sold as a medicine and as a way to heat and light things. The problems with oil in the Middle East were there then, same as they are today. As a matter of fact, it was a major source of income for those people, was the selling of petroleum. The term asphalt comes from the hardened blocks of asphalt that they would find in the sand and that they would use to glue the bricks together. They would also use it as paving blocks. So the whole idea of asphalt highways is as old as Babylon. As a matter of fact, the word asphalt stands for asphalt. That was a brilliant moment, wasn't it? So the question would be, so how hot was the furnace? I want you to think about something. Back in 1991, you remember 1991? Something happened at that time. Before that, prior to that in 1990, the very end of 1990, Iraq invaded Kuwait. And when our forces came up against them and began to move into Kuwait, the Iraqis began to abandon the area, and they decided what they would do is they would light all of the oil wells afire. And all of these oil wells coming up, and the oil and the smoke coming up, they hoped would totally block out all of the technology that the Americans and the coalition forces had so that they couldn't see in order to destroy the Iraqi forces as they retreated. So they set a fire over 700 oil wells, and the temperature of those fires as they began to put them out, it took about 4 months for them to totally put all of these fires out. It exceeded 1,600 degrees. Think about that for just a moment. 1,600 degrees. Steel melts at around 2,800 degrees. 1,600 degrees. Aluminum melts around 600 to 800 degrees. Lead a little over 500. So you can imagine what this was like, to be in around a fire that was 1,600 degrees. So our best estimates for this particular furnace would at least be 1,000 to more than 1,000 degrees. So if you can imagine for just a moment what this was like. Here these men are up on top of this furnace. They're about to be thrown into it. You have all of that heat. If you've ever been around a furnace like that, then you know what I'm talking about. And the heat is excessive. And you don't just feel it when you get up against it. You feel it long before you get there. This kind of a temperature you would feel from the door to here, this 1,000 and better degrees. So look at the verses there again. Look at verse 20. The writer here shows us something that's very important. And what he's doing here, the king, is he's taking these powerful soldiers and he's binding these Jews. And what he wants to do is he wants to ensure that no human or divine intervention occurs. The last thing that he wants is for these guys to get away. And there's a note of fear here because he wants to make sure that there is no human intervention, but there's no divine intervention. Because, you know, he knows something about this God that he's dealing with. 20 years before, this God answered his dream. But look what happens in verse 22. The king becomes rebuked. Look what happens when these burly soldiers come up here and they're carrying these men to the top. You see, it's almost as if God rebukes them and he takes his breath and he blows those flames at them. Look what happens in the verse. The raging flames killed those men who carried Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego up. And you see, as followers of Christ, we need to understand that the same hand that protects us will often strike those who strike us. It doesn't always happen. We don't have a guarantee. You don't have an unqualified guarantee that anything bad that ever happens to you will now come back on the other person, like people talk of karma. There is no such thing, by the way. But God, in his vengeance, you remember what he tells us? He says, "Vengeance is mine. I will repay. I will take care of it." So when you have someone do something to you, you don't have to take it into your own hands. Doesn't mean you don't protect yourselves, but you don't have to take it into your own hands to get back at people. God will take care of that for you. And in the apocryphal addition to Daniel, the writing says this, that the flames ascended over 73 feet above the mouth of the furnace. So if you can imagine for just a moment, this is relatively what? We may have about 75 feet here. So if you can imagine the flames at least this tall coming up out of the furnace. And God looks at those soldiers, those burly soldiers, and he goes, "Poof," and the flame bends and comes down on them and consumes them. Now notice what happens to the men as this is happening. You see, there's a sidebar here that we would miss in verse 23 if we didn't look at it and think about it for just a moment. God does something here when he destroys these soldiers. And what he's doing here is he's telling Nebuchadnezzar and everyone there that it is God who will make the decision for when these men will go into the furnace. You see, in our affliction, in everything that happens to us, it is God and God alone who makes the decision about how far the affliction will come on you, how strong that affliction will come on you, and the time and the length of it. Nothing will ever come against you except by his allowance. No matter how terrible it is, you can always depend that God's hand is in it and watching over you. It doesn't mean that he's causing it. But he sets limits for what comes against you. And he's taking care of you and watching over you. In Matthew 10, Jesus affirms this care of God. And listen to what he says in Matthew 10, 29 and 31. "Aren't two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them falls to the ground without your Father's consent. Don't be afraid, therefore. You are worth more than many sparrows." You see, and as these men were listening, as these disciples were listening to Jesus say this, no doubt their mind went back to this passage. And they thought about these three men as they were being cast into the furnace. And they thought about the fact that God is the one who determined the moment that they went in. You see, these men intended to cast them in and have the honor of casting them in. But God tumbled them in. Because you see, as the fire consumed them, their grasp loosened and the men tumbled into the furnace. Look again at verse 24 and 26. And I want you to notice what happens as they're delivered from the fire. And the first thing that you need to notice here is the king's sadistic pride is humbled. You see, Nebuchadnezzar in verse 24 is sitting with the intention of watching these men burn alive. You can imagine for just a moment, if you will, that he's sitting there in his lawn chair of the day and he's sitting back and he has his drink and perhaps some chips and dip and he's sitting there and he's watching. And he's thinking to himself, "This is going to be fun. I'm going to enjoy this." But look what happens to him as he's watching. And if you remember just a few days ago, there was an incident in a zoo where a gorilla was dragging a young boy along, and they had to kill the gorilla to protect the child. And a lot of people have become very, very upset over this. As a matter of fact, they've held candlelight vigils for this gorilla. I don't know what they think will happen because of this, but they're holding these candlelight vigils as almost as if they would rather that the child had died and the gorilla had survived. And you see, for most of us, as we watched that, I couldn't even hardly watch the video. this child being dragged around like a doll. And I'm thinking to myself, how terrible is that? And people get so worked up over these kinds of things, and they seem to take an enjoyment out of watching suffering. But there's something visceral inside of us that says, that's wrong. That there's something wrong about watching somebody suffer. But you see, to Nebuchadnezzar, and to many today, life is so cheap. You see, he thinks no more of burning these men than of roasting a pig on a spit. You see, to him, this is no big deal. This is what you do. People don't obey, you burn them up. It's no big deal. You know, they would say, and I know I've shared with you many things about World War II, but they would say of Adolf Hitler that those opposed him, he would have them hung with piano wire while he would force the party men to watch them as they struggled, as the wire cut into them. Not even having mercy enough to use a rope, but use piano wire to make it as difficult as possible. And you see, one of the effects of modern entertainment has been to raise the shock value of what is seen in order to keep the audience interested. You see, it used to be when we would watch a movie, they would show a scene, somebody was shot, but you really didn't see anything happen. You just know they got hit and they fell down, right? Now, with all the technology that we have, you see the person literally being blown apart. And that's not even good enough. And so they have to keep upping the ante because people get bored with watching that because they want to see more. They want more violence. They want more action. They want more special features. And you see, at this time, Nebuchadnezzar's mind, it wants more. He wants the effect, the shock value. You see, there's great shock value in watching these people suffer, watching them burn in front of you. Because what it will do is it'll solidify his authority over everyone else because no one else is wanting to go into that furnace. Look at the verses there. He looks at them and God sends him a shock value. And he shocks the king. And look at what the king does. He jumps up. He literally comes up out of his seat and he jumps up in alarm. This man who had been in total control is now out of control. The complete rebuke. And I want you to think about something. When he comes to this, to the window of the furnace, the door of the furnace, and he's there, and he calls to these men. There's a miracle that happens here that you might not know about. And it'd be easy to miss if you don't know something about fire. You cannot call over fire. If you're on the other side of a large fire, you cannot be heard. Your sound will not travel. You have to actually move to the side of the fire for your voice to travel. So the fact that he's able to call to them and they're able to hear him is a miracle in itself. All right, so look at what happens here. A sight to see. Just take a look at what happens. And I want you to notice what the king is seeing. The first thing he sees is that the men are totally unbound. God took those cords. The only thing that's burnt, as you all well know, are the cords that bound them. And the second thing is that they're walking. And the third thing is that they're accompanied by a guardian. And if you look at this, you kind of get the idea that they're kind of strolling along as if they're on a summer pleasure walk. They're just kind of walking along. They're having a conversation. All of this is going on. The flames are roaring up. It must have been a beautiful sight if you really think about it. It must have been absolutely beautiful to watch this thing happen. Just the majesty of it. You know, the angels and Christ himself are often described as being flames of fire. You can imagine what that must have looked like. Just watching them walking along, strolling, and having a casual conversation with his angel. You know, the King James and some of the other versions pronounce it as the Son of God, but the actual reading is like a son of the gods. And so here it's happening, and Isaiah had promised something in 43 verse 2. He had promised something to these Jews 100 and some odd years before it happened, as they were getting ready to go into this captivity. And he told them something. God wanted them to know something about what he would do when they went into these situations. And here's how it reads, Isaiah 43:2, I will be with you when you pass through the waters. And when you pass through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. You will not be scorched when you walk through the fire, and the flame will not burn you. But I want you to notice something here, and that is he didn't promise them that they would never suffer. He didn't promise them that they were going to have a rose garden existence. But what he did promise them was that he would always be there and they would not be destroyed in their suffering. Warren Wiersbe put it this way. He said, the safest place in all the world is to be in the will of God, no matter where you are. I remember a few months ago when those men were taken out on the beach there in Libya, and they were marched out onto the beach by ISIS. One of them wasn't a believer, even though he was mixed in with this group of believers. And the reports are that he actually became a Christian moments before he was executed. So here they are. They're bowing their heads down to the sand. They're in the will of God, the safest place to be. And you look at something like that and you think, how in the world could they bow down? You know, I was thinking about this yesterday. The boys caught a cottonmouth down there where we were, and they brought it up to where we were to show it to us. And it was alive at the time. And so they dump it out of their little bucket that they've been carrying it with, and it's slithering and striking and doing its thing. And, you know, we're very close to the wedding ceremony, you know, where this is happening, about 100 yards off. And I said, it's probably a wise thing, since there will be many more ceremonies at this place, that you all go ahead and kill this snake. It's a poisonous snake. And so they did that, and they took care of it. And I thought to myself, as we were driving home last night, and I was thinking about all of this, and I was thinking about these beheadings and things that are happening. And I thought, what did that snake feel? It was an object lesson of the reality of this and of what's going through the mind of a person as this happens to them. But they're in the will of God. Okay, it's sidebar. And I want you to think about what's being said to these men. What they said to the king. You see, they looked at him and they said, no matter the outcome, be it life or death, we know our God is going to be with us. And you see, that's exactly what we see happening here. No matter the outcome, no matter the events, God is with them. But look again at verse 26 and notice the king's confession. Notice what he says to them. And it's very, very important that as we look at this, that we catch some important points that all of us struggle with, and all of us will have to answer. Now, listen to what happens. The first thing he says to them is he says, you servants of the Most High God. Look at a few moments. This has just been a very, very few moments, maybe 15, 20 minutes from the beginning of all of this to this point. And he looks at them, and he's gone from boasting to fear and humility. You see, in verse 15, he had boasted, who is the God who will rescue you? You know, who do you think you are? My God is Marduk. My God is Baal. He will take care of you. He's the fire god. Who do you think you are? But now he has to admit that the Most High God, you servants of the Most High God, he has his answer to his question. But notice the double miracle here. In addition from being protected from the burning, the witnesses pick up on something that's equally as miraculous. And the first one is the men don't smell like smoke. If you've ever been around a fire, if you've ever gone camping, you know the smell of smoke. These men don't smell. The second is their hair is not singed. Look at the verses. Their hair is not singed and their clothes are not scorched. You see, it was as if the fire didn't even exist. And you can imagine these men as they cast a glance, these witnesses, as they look at the furnace, they see the smoke coming up, they see the flames coming up 70 some odd feet, they feel the heat coming off of the mouth of the furnace and the door of the furnace, and they're saying to themselves, what happened here? What happened to these men? And they go up to them, and you can imagine they're touching them and they're smelling them. They're probably lined up one after another like a procession, smelling them and touching them. What happened? And they're looking at each other in amazement. And you can imagine they are now bowing before them. Because the last thing that they want to do is to offend that God. Because also upon that platform is something else. What is upon that platform? The bodies of those what? Of those soldiers. Those bodies of those soldiers are up there still smoldering. But look at these men. And in fear, they most likely bowed before them. But look at verse 28 and 29 and notice the king's proclamation and notice the violent extremes that he goes to. The first one is that he praises the God of the Jews in verse 28. You see, he recognizes that God has provided divine protection and he acknowledges the Jews' faithfulness. Look at what he says, the servants who trusted in him. And you'll often find in life, as you go through life, that the very people who make fun of you, who ridicule you because of your faith, when they're in a situation where they need help, who do they come running to? The one that they make fun of, don't they? Because they know something about you, and that is that you are a servant of the most what? High God. And they will come to you. And the second one is, he issues a decree in verse 29. Anyone who blasphemes the God of the Jews will be tortured. Look at this, tortured. He can't get off this torture thing, can he? He loves this. He loves torture. And his house will be turned into a dump. But look at 29b and notice something here. He misses the point. You see, God has done something miraculous for him, and he misses the whole point of what God has just done. Look at it there. 20 years have gone by, and he's missed the point. He's been given the same lesson twice. Listen to his words and notice his mistake, for there is no other God who is able to deliver like this. You see, even after all this, he's not willing to admit that Yahweh is the high God. He still wants to link him with all the lesser gods. Look at it again. There is no other God who's able to deliver like this. In other words, those other gods are still important, and I will still serve them. Yahweh has certainly proven that he is the God, but I still will do this. And I want you to think about your own life for just a minute as you look at this. Paul asked a question of King Agrippa in Acts 26. He looked at him and he said this to him. He says, "Do you believe the evidence placed before you?" And you see, that's the question that Nebuchadnezzar now has in front of you. And every day you face the same question. Do you believe the evidence that's placed in front of you? Are you following Christ or are you simply just following a bunch of rules because that's what you do? You know, I looked at some people yesterday as we were there and one of them came up to me and asked me to say a blessing over the meal. And I'm thinking to myself, you're all drinking. You all have no relationship with God whatsoever, but you want the meal blessed. You have a trapping of religion, but you don't want nothing to do with the God of it. You only want the form of it. But look at this for just a minute. I want you to think about something here. In your life, do you simply lump God with all the other gods? Think about it. Think about it for just a moment. Do you simply do that? Do you lump God along with your looks? Are your looks so important to you that you'll be vain about it? Is what you have so important that it becomes more important than God? Is your attitude the kind of attitude that's in rebellion against him? Is it okay to have him as long as he's protecting you, but your attitude says, but I will still maintain control of my own life. I will do it my way because I'm in charge. You see, every day we're placed in circumstances where the temperature of the furnace is turned up. You see, as followers of Christ, we have a situation every day almost where that temperature is being turned up. This came to me as I was studying this and I thought, yes, that's true. And then God began to deal with my heart and he began to say to me, I'm turning the temperature up. How are you reacting? And I began to think about that. And when I would be faced with those situations, I would say, the temperature is going up, Lord, but I will follow you. And it's a tough thing when you think about that. But every day we face those. And we have to think, how are we reacting to that? Are we losing our cool? Are we overreacting? Or as followers of Christ, are we determining that we are going to be faithful no matter the temperature? Think about it for just a minute. Let's all stand. Our Father, we are here in front of you. We are people who have gathered together, obviously, to worship you. And I pray that you will look at our hearts and examine us. Look at us. Are we just lumping you together with all the other gods of the world? And do we retain that small place in our hearts that's ours and ours alone? And we close that door and we say, no, you can't have that. That's mine. Father, you're never going to break that lock. You don't own the key, we do. But you won't break the lock. Help us in our brokenness to come to you and say, Lord, we'll take that key and we'll turn that key and open that door, and then we'll throw the key away. Father, if there's someone here who doesn't know you, they're just living their life and life is good, they really haven't faced those problems yet that tend to drive us to you, but I pray that they will see that to follow you is the best way to go. It's the most joyous way. It's the most full way. Teach us, Father, to walk with you. Draw all of us, every single one here, together in a spirit of unity and a hungering after you. In Jesus' name, amen.